Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 176, Interview with Gardner Dozois and Rich Horton. This episode is brought to you by the new Kickstarter campaign, Tome of Ideas for Writers and Roleplayers. To learn more, visit our website and click on the image for Tome of Ideas.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. This is Brent Bowen with special co-host Brian Thomas Schmidt. Brian, say hello.
Hey.
And we're at Conquest 43 in Kansas City. We're so pleased to welcome our next guest, renowned Year's Best Anthology editors and Locus short story reviewers Gardner Dozois and Rich Horton to talk about the state of short fiction. Gardner, Rich, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I've got to admit, I'm a subscriber and truly am a fan of Locus. Really enjoy Locus, the magazine, but not only the magazine. I really enjoy the site as well, and especially because they publish these interview excerpts that are little time capsules, and one in particular, Gardner, caught my interest from about 15 years ago. And it's in one of these interviews, you had mentioned that at that time, in 1997, right, we were in the golden age of science fiction. So, Gardner, Rich, that's the first question. Where do you think we are now? 15 years ago was the golden age. Where are we now?
I think in some ways the standards of writing in the field are higher than they've ever been. The bar has really been raised to a very high level. In my first days in the field in the early 60s, you could, you know, get by as long as you could write a marginal sentence. It didn't even have to be that good. But now the standards for prose at the top are set very high, and you have to also have accurate science or, you know, up-to-date gobbledygook at least, and you have to be able to create believable, realistic characters with emotional complexity, and it really has gotten more and more difficult as the years have gone by to write top-level science fiction, and I think that the writers are meeting the challenge admirably. I mean, there are some writers out there who write mostly science fiction who are as good in the prose department as anybody in the so-called mainstream. So I think we're doing pretty good.
I'd agree, absolutely. The quality of writing's never been higher. State of the market, especially the short fiction market, is probably not as good. We all know magazine, you know, Realms of Fantasy died three times in the last 3 years. Finally put a stake in it, I think. And all the circulations of most of the magazines seem to be going down. But the stories in there are as good as they've ever been.
Actually, I don't think it's quite that bleak because, for one thing, you have, although the print magazines like Realms of Fantasy have died, you have a lot of new online electronic magazines that have come into being in the last couple of years, and most of them are pretty good, doing high quality stuff. Tor.com, Lightspeed, Clark's World, they're all doing work as good as most of the stuff, at least in the print magazines. And also, even the print magazines have ironically seen an upkick in subscriptions due to the internet, due to the fact that they can sell electronic downloadable versions of the magazines through the internet, has actually in some cases kicked their subscription levels up a notch or two. So ironically, if anything can save the print magazines, it's the very electronic media and internet that many people thought were going to kill them off altogether. Not that it's a sure thing that they're going to survive by any means, but it's not entirely bleak.
Well, that's a fair point. And it's harder for us to track exactly the subscriptions to the electronic markets because they aren't printed in the back of the magazine. But word of mouth says that the major print magazines actually are selling very healthily in their ebook versions.
I wanted to ask you guys what led you down the editorial path. And Gardner, I know that you have won a couple of nebulas, at least for short stories.
Yeah, two nebulas.
And in a row, right?
Yeah, and a sidewise award for best alternate history.
Great, and you started editing like 30 years ago, the year's best. You were working with Jim Frinkle at a different publisher for five or six of them, right?
That's not quite true. Jim Frinkle started the current Best of the Year series at Blue Jay, and we did, I think, three editions before Blue Jay folded and the line was taken over by St. Martin's Press. And we're now up to my 29th collection is just coming out in a month or so. But what a lot of people don't realize is that I had done six editions for a different, completely different Best of the Year series for Dutton before I ever even got started with Blue Jay. So if you add those six in, it's like 36 years or something that I've been doing those.
Is that the series that Lester Del Rey started?
Yeah, Lester Del Rey started the series. He did the first three, and then he decided he didn't want to do it anymore, and he dropped out. And they were looking around for another editor, and Isaac Asimov, in fact, recommended me, and so I took over the series and ran it for another six books before they died altogether. And then a year or so later, Jim Frinkle asked me to start the Blue Jay series.
Rich, I wanted to ask you, because I know a little bit less about your background than I do about Gardner's. How did you get started editing? Did you come from a writing background? What's your background that kind of led you into editing?
No, I haven't written any fiction. I haven't won any nebulas. I started writing reviews for Dave Truesdale's Tangent magazine, which reviewed short fiction, back in the late 90s. And when I started doing that, I started publishing on newsgroups, basically, lists of what I thought the best of the year stories were. And I started to organize them into, if I was editing an anthology, and I picked an anthology the length of Gardner's because it's nice and long and you don't have to leave as much out, these are the stories I'd include. And after a few years, I thought to myself, you know, online magazines are becoming more important and nobody's highlighting that. So I suggested to Sean Wallace at Prime, would you like to do an anthology of the best stories of the year from online sources? And Sean said, that'll never sell. And so that was a no. A year later, he came back and said, well, what about just a general best of the year collection? And so I started doing those. We started out with two half-sized anthologies, one devoted to science fiction and one devoted to fantasy. And that was mainly because there was a mass market version that wanted thinner books. After a few years, we combined them together into one big book, just about as big as Gardner's book. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
Gotcha. Well, and so, Gardner, how did you actually get involved with Year's Best? The thing about, for me, when I read, like, I showed you the fantasy and science fiction that I found from the 80s, and here they said, oh, well, Gardner Desois is primarily known for his novels. And I said, wait a minute, he's primarily known as an editor, isn't he? I didn't know, you know, for people might. How did you move? It seems like you're known more for editing now than you were then.
Actually, I'm not particularly known for novels. I was primarily a short story writer, although I have written three novels in my day. Considering that I've got like a 50-year career, that's not a really a lot. But I had hit New York City in the late 60s, early 70s, and had sold a lot of short stories to mostly to the anthologies that were the hot sexy market of the day were these original anthologies that, like, Robert Silverberg was doing New Dimensions, and Damon Knight was doing Orbit, and Terry Carr was doing Universe, and I had sold to all of these. So for a brief while there, I had a reputation as a hot new writer, and I had gotten to meet most of the people in New York publishing because I lived up in Milford, Pennsylvania for a while, which at that time, because it was the home of Damon Knight and Kate Wilhelm, was sort of the center of the science fiction universe on the East Coast. And everybody went through Milford at one point or another, so I met most of them. So to make a long story short, when I moved down into New York City and I was living in this incredibly crappy slum apartment with hot and cold running cockroaches on the Lower East Side, which was so grim at that point that the Viet Cong used to send their troops to the Lower East Side for survival training before shipping them over to Vietnam. But at any rate, I was down there being incredibly broke, almost having no money at all, and I managed to use these contacts to get into doing some reading of novels, and you write a report on it for various publishing houses. So I did that for a while, and that led to me being picked to work as the slush reader at Galaxy, Worlds of If, Worlds of Tomorrow, Worlds of Fantasy. It was the four magazines, the UPD group at that point. So I worked there for a couple of years where I was pleased to have fished out of the slush pile people like George R. R. Martin, Joe Haldeman, and Michael Bishop. So I thought, you know, I had done fairly did a pretty good track record there. So I did that for a couple of years, and then when I stopped doing that, I was in New York. People knew who I was. I had a reputation as a writer, and I had a reputation of having done a good job reading the slush piles for these magazines. So, when Lester Del Rey dropped out, then my name came to the surface, and I said, well, why not get him? And so that's how I started working in editing, and that led eventually, after I'd done the Dutton books and a few of the Blue Jay books, you know, Asimov's science fiction magazine started. And because I lived in Philadelphia at that point and I knew the field, they got me as the associate editor. And I did that for a couple of years, and then the editor and I didn't agree and came to a parting of the ways. And somewhat to my own surprise, about 10 years later, I was at a Nebula Award banquet, and Shauna McCarthy, who at the time was the editor of Asimov's magazine, came up to me during the banquet and said, how would you like to be the new Asimov's editor? Because she had been working with me as a writer, published several of my stories, including one of my Nebula winners. And I said, well, okay. And so I took over Asimov's and kept the Best of the Year going at the same time. So that's how I got into the very boring story of how I got into editing.
No, it's interesting. You know, it's a proof to the, you know, fellow writers and those of us who listen to this, you know, the connections really are important. The networking is key to the path you're going to take. I mean, you wouldn't have probably predicted that path, you know, all those years ago that you would end up doing it. But, you know, I mean, it's just the way it works out with those kind of things. One of the questions I had for you is, what factors come into play when picking year's best stories? I mean, do you try to vary the venue where the stories originated? Is genre a factor? You know, sometimes I know I've seen critics say, oh, well, they have way more fantasy than science fiction. Does that matter? Do you think about that? Do you think about having, you know, is it fair to have only one story per author? Or if the stories are really best, would you put two stories by somebody in there?
Let Rich take it. I've been blabbing a lot.
Sure, all those kind of things.
We do try to vary the venues, and we have an informal limit of X number of stories, and I won't say what X is, from any given source. All those rules are breakable if you have to break them. But part of the idea is you don't want someone to say, well, I already read that whole thing in Asimov's, why should I buy another copy? And genre for us isn't a significant factor. I mean, it's got to be science fiction or fantasy, or slipstream, which usually counts as some variety of fantasy, and we don't publish that much of that. I don't make any conscious attempt to balance it, but every year it looks to me, when I count them, that it comes out about half and half science fiction and fantasy. Even though I personally, if you ask me, I would say I like science fiction a little more than I like fantasy, especially at short lengths. But that's the way it tends to come out. When I had the shorter books, I always limited it to one story per author, and I've only half broken that so far. One year I published, with the thicker books, a story by Elizabeth Baer and a collaboration by Baer with Sarah Monette. But for the bigger book, I think it's not unreasonable to publish a couple stories by the same author. When you had a small book and only a dozen, maybe 15 stories, it almost did seem unfair at some level. And sometimes you regret that. I published Robert Reed's Hugo winner, A Billion Eves, one year, and he had another story that year that was just outstanding called 8 Episodes. It didn't get as much notice. Didn't win Hugo. And I would have loved to publish that one, too. It was well worth it, but I had decided one per author, and that's where I stopped. For other practical considerations, every year there's contractual issues. There's a writer who has a story collection coming out where there's a contractual limitation. It can't be published in another book within the first year or something like that. There's mainstream authors. I try to use occasional stories by mainstream authors if they're good enough, and there are more and more who are writing science fiction. They are a lot more reluctant because I don't think they know our market, and they don't care that much in many cases, or their agents don't. The writers are often, oh, sure, that'd be great. Let me talk to my agent. And the agent will say, either, okay, pay us our normal rate, which is dwarfs what we would ordinarily pay, or they would just sort of avoid the subject. The other practical consideration is length, and that's obvious, but there's so many great novellas in the field. Every year it seems like I could publish 10 of them, but if I did, it would be a book of the best novellas and there wouldn't be any room for short stories and novelettes. So sometimes, you know, you have to balance it that way.
Yeah, well, I because my book is like started 30 years ago when it wasn't common to mix the genres, the title of my book is Year's Best Science Fiction. And I try pretty much to hold the line to publishing science fiction because of the fact that that's what it says you're getting on the cover. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a few stories, no doubt, which blur the line a little. But for the most part, I try to stick to SF. And it's true, everything Rich said, you can't use too much from one source. My main criterion is that I really like the story. I mean, people are very disappointed at this. They think I have some complicated aesthetic formula.
Some algorithm.
That I use to grind some sort of polemical axe. But the fact is that I go by the stories that I like, and I pick the stories that I like as a reader, and then I will look at them and see that some of them will have to be eliminated because you can't have 7 stories from the same source in the same book. This is particularly true when I used to edit Asimov's, and there would be grumbles if I used too many Asimov stories in the best of the year, so I had to try to not use more than a certain number of Asimov stories. And of course, even with a book as big as mine, there are some practical length considerations, although I try to get 3 or 4, if I can, novellas into the volume every year because there's so many good novellas out there. And as Rich said, there are some people that just won't sell you their story for whatever reason. It's often the agent in case of mainstream authors and even some of the bigger genre authors. They don't want to be bothered to play for the pittance that we can pay for a reprint. And there are some people that just don't, for whatever reason, they don't want to sell you the rights to their story. So there's always something that slips through. The last few years, Subterranean, for instance, has published some very good novellas, but some of them they also republish as individual chapbooks, and they tie the rights up on those for like 3 years or something. They can't be reprinted anywhere after, for 3 years after the chapbook comes out. And so I've lost a couple of lost a couple of stories that way. Now, I do make an effort, which I've come to realize is almost totally a waste of time, but I do make an effort to balance the book as far as not only how much, well, it's not a factor for me how much science fiction, how much fantasy, because it all ostensibly is science fiction, at least by my own rather large tent definition. But I try to balance the book in that I don't want two or three really depressing stories next to each other, and I don't want like two near future stories next to each other. I'd like to get like a far future story in there, or an off planet story or something to break up the tone. And I used to do the same thing with Asimov, so I'd be very careful. Like, I would start off with a more optimistic story, and then I would have a near future story, and then I would have a far future story, and vary the emotional tone and the kind of subgenre that it was. And I still do this, but it's almost certainly a waste of time, because I found out that the vast majority of people, when they open my Best of the Year, don't read it in order from front to back. They jump around, they read the story first from their favorite author, and then they start with the longest story first, or they start with the shortest stories first. So they're not paying any attention to this careful order that I've worked out. And the same was
they have a mind of their own.
And yes, they do. The bastards. How dare they do that? And the same was true with Asimov's. You know, they wouldn't read the magazine cover to cover. They would do the same kind of jumping around. So it's a waste of time, but I do it anyway.
Well, let me apologize on behalf of those people, because I'm one of them. Ellen Datlow got mad at me when I confessed that, but it's true. I do that. I mean, you know,
all of the time and trouble we editors go to for you, working our fingers to the bone with blood oozing out, and do you care? No.
Well, I'll tell you what I read first out of yours that is so important is the yearly roundup that you do at the beginning of your anthology. And one follow-up to this I wanted to ask you, both of you, because I know you both kind of do it when you do it for Locus, which I'm sure is advantageous since you're already doing the reading for the Year's Best. But, I mean, how do you keep up with all the immense amount of reading necessary to come up with something like that? I can't imagine. I mean, I read a lot of books, too, but it's just an immense amount of reading.
I read a lot fewer novels now
than
I used to read. That's one thing that happens. I just do a lot of reading. That's all it is.
Are you fast readers?
I think I'm relatively fast, but I'm not tremendously fast. When I was a kid, I made an effort to become a speed reader. And it was about the age of 14 that I was assigned to read Shakespeare, and I found he was pretty good. I also found you can't read poetry at any kind of speed. And once I adjusted my reading to be able to read that, I couldn't read anything else any faster.
I agree. You can't speed read fiction. You have to read it line by line at a reasonable pace to get any sort of nuance out of it. With me, again, as with Rich, I don't read many novels anymore. We must read thousands of stories every year. And one way you can sort of cheat that a little is, for instance, I don't read anything labeled as straight horror, because I don't use horror in my book. So that cuts out a lot. I don't read more than enough of a slipstream story to identify that it's a slipstream story, because I don't use slipstream in my book. And I usually read the fantasy anyway, because I like fantasy. But again, you know, if I'm rushed for time, I don't have to read something labeled as a fantasy, because I don't use fantasy in my book. So that cuts it down to a certain degree. And also, as somebody famously said, you don't have to eat all of an egg to tell that it's bad. I mean, often with the really bad stories, you can tell within a few paragraphs that there's no way you're going to put this in something called the Year's Best.
Right.
So that cuts down on the time a little bit.
So it's kind of like a slush reader or anybody else?
Yeah, I've had lots of experience as a slush reader. Sure. So I like to say that I've probably read more bad short science fiction than anybody in the world. Of course, the good part is I've also read more good short science fiction than anybody in the world. So,
and by now I may be close to second, although I haven't read slush ever. So I don't think I've read as much really bad stuff as Gardner has, except for, and I shouldn't say this because maybe people start doing more of it, every once in a while somebody emails me something out of the blue and says, read my novel or read my short story and tell me how to fix it.
Oh.
And it usually needs a lot of fixing, but not...
You
actually read those?
No. The first paragraph is...
Just like breaking out the paddles.
Or the illustration that they have hand-done to put in front of it, and they've mailed it to me in that form.
Yeah.
You need to hang garlic or something around your neck to ward off these evil things.
It took me a long time to train myself that it wasn't necessary for me to read everything. I used to try to read every single thing that I got.
Can't be done.
And I think I got up to close to 3,000 stories one year. But I was reading some of these bottom of the barrel, and I'm sorry to say this about these things, which are works of true love in many cases, but they're just not very good in many cases. Now, every once in a while, you find some tiny magazine that doesn't look very promising and turns out to be really good. And then a couple years later, it'll be Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet or something that's truly outstanding. But it's not that common. And so it took me a long time to train myself that, no, I don't have to read every single thing. And if something's really rotten, I don't have to read the whole story.
That's the hardest thing to do when training a slush pile reader, in fact, is to train them not to take too much time with the manuscripts. You ought to be able to tell within a couple of minutes at most if a manuscript has any chance. And with novice slush readers, they'll say, well, I didn't read it all, you know. And, well, that's the name of the game. You know, you already determined it's not going to work for the magazine. That's the point where you stop and move on to something else.
Well, I think part of that come from the fact that so many of the slush readers are up-and-coming writers? And I know for me, when I was reading slush, it was kind of like, I want to give this guy a chance. I don't want to feel like I didn't give the person a fair shot.
Yeah, you would have made a lousy slush reader for that. You got to be with slush and potato. And you don't know, Rich, if you haven't read slush, nothing that gets published is anywhere near as bad as the worst of the stuff in the slush pile, even the really crappy stuff. I mean, you have to go down to another whole new definition of crappy to, you know, describe the stuff in the slush pile.
Now, if anybody watches Mad Men, the most recent episode had one of the ad men who had been fired from the agency a few years ago shows up and tries to push a Star Trek script on one of on the guy that handles the TV for them. And by all accounts, it was as bad as any slush story.
Well, this has got nothing to do with the panel, but interestingly, there was a rumor that this character from Mad Men was based on Frederick Pohl, who had worked in a lot of advertising agencies in his day. He has denied this on his blog. He said that it's not him. So
there was another character in Mad Men.
Selling to Galaxy?
Selling to Galaxy.
Yeah, that's who they said Pohl was, yeah.
Yeah, he was. The character could not be confused with Fred Pohl. But it was it was nice to see. They treated it completely respectably.
Well, what's his name? The captain from Deep Space Nine sold stories to Galaxy, too, as I remember one episode. I didn't see him in the slush pile. Didn't see anything from Cisco in the slush pile when I was reading Galaxy, though.
This episode is brought to you by the Kickstarter campaign Tome of Ideas for Writers and Roleplayers by Michael J. Weiniger. Tome of Ideas is part genre encyclopedia, part RPG book, part writing prompt collection, and part inspirational art book. It is designed as a resource for writers looking for their next story, game masters looking for their next adventure, or anyone who simply wants to sit down and send their imagination on a journey into speculative fiction. Contributors include over 20 award-winning and best-selling authors who will help provide writing prompts and story ideas to get you started on your next adventure. For more information, please go to Kickstarter.com and search for Tome of Ideas, or come to AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com and click on the image you'll find on the homepage for Tome of Ideas, a new Kickstarter campaign by Michael J. Weiniger.
Well, speaking of things that are dead and buried like slush, Rich, you had alluded to this earlier, which was Realms of Fantasy and its multiple deaths. And you even, in the year's best, talked about trending or favoring science fiction over fantasy. And, you know, as far as we can tell, FNSF is the sole remaining print market, really.
I did for one more market. It's the British magazine Black Static.
Which trends a little dark fantasy slash horror.
But it's still publishing fantasy.
Yeah, it's still publishing.
I consider that mostly horror, though.
That's true. But I published one of their stories a few years ago in the science fiction volume. Or I selected it for science fiction volume. It may have ended up in a combined volume. And it was a science fiction story with a dark edge, an outstanding story.
First of all, why do you think that fantasy struggles to succeed in the short market, at least in the print marketplace?
Well, that's a very important caveat, because while there aren't that many print magazines left, the default setting for practically every website out there that publishes fiction is fantasy, soft horror, slipstream. What's hard to find in the electronic markets is actual short science fiction. I mean, some of the top markets will do it, but you know, down from there, it's mostly fantasy and slipstream. I've wondered myself, as far as the print market goes, as far as I know, every attempt to do a all fantasy magazine or to do an all-fantasy original anthology series, and there have been five or six of them over the last 20 years, has died. And at a time when fantasy vastly outsells science fiction in print, this is kind of peculiar. The only thing I can think of is that many fantasy fans like great big huge books and multi-volume series, and they're just not into short stories. I had a panel I did once years ago about this very topic, and this woman said that she didn't read short stories at all because what she wanted out of the reading experience was to get an enormous fat novel and to settle comfortably down into it for the weekend, like you would settle into a hot bath and not emerge again until she was done. You can't do that with a short story.
Well, you know, I asked James Gunn that question a couple weeks ago at a signing he was at with me, and he said, you know, part of the thing may be the fact that science fiction is so good about just taking an idea and doing a story on an idea, whereas fantasy tends to be more character-driven, and there's a bigger world involvement, and it's harder to do that in a short story. I mean, I don't know if those are factors or not.
But. Oh, there's also Beneath Ceaseless Skies that's on the net and prints a lot of fantasy.
And they're very good. I can add one more data point. When I was publishing separate science fiction and fantasy volumes, the fantasy volume sold consistently less than the science fiction volume. So fantasy short stories don't seem to sell as well. I really think that the interest in writers for big, long books is a big part of it. On the other hand, in the urban fantasy / paranormal market, the books aren't as long, although they're usually parts of series. And I think people like them for different reasons.
I don't think the markets overlap that much. There is a little overlap. But I think the market for paranormal romance and the market for fantasy and the market for science fiction, although there's a Venn diagram in there where they connect, it's not a big overlap. Subterranean also publishes good fantasy. You know, that and Beneath Ceaseless Skies are good places to find genre fantasy as opposed to slipstream. A lot of the other markets are more heavily into slipstream, but you won't find that much actual genre fantasy in it.
Lightspeed now also publishes.
I was going to say Lightspeed.
Splits fantasy. It used to be separate. Lightspeed was one magazine, fantasy magazine was the other, but they're combined now.
They've actually, I think so far this year, their fantasy has been better than their science fiction.
I remarked something like that in one of my more recent columns, that for some reason I'm liking the fantasy better, even though they published some truly outstanding science fiction in past years, so I'd say it's a statistical fluke.
Now, I've always wondered why, with Realms of Fantasy, it's clear they have a dedicated readership, but it's also clear that readership is not large enough to commercially support a print magazine. I've always wondered why they didn't make it an electronic magazine where the printing costs would be, you know, there wouldn't be any printing costs, production costs would be more manageable. But for some reason, that doesn't seem to be considered by them as an alternative.
I have one more question, then Brent has one, and we'll kind of wrap up. I'm wondering, you know, what's the significance for me if I'm a writer? and my work isn't in the year's best, you know, year after year, should it matter? Should I give up my career?
No.
What's the real significance of having the story in the year's best? It's objective. You've kind of both talked about. Does it have any significance for a writer?
I think it's got ego-stroking significance. I think a lot of people say, this is validation that my story is in the best of the year. Does it have any practical effect on your career? Probably not. I mean, nor frankly does winning most awards, and even winning most awards has slightly more practical value than being in the best of the year. Also, things are so subjective. All the best of the year editor really has to sell is his taste. Mm. And you might not make it into my best of the year, but you make it into somebody else's best of the year. So, I would say it doesn't. It's nice to have your story noticed and validated. But other than that, it's certainly not going to make or break you as a writer.
People used to ask me if I called Gardner or Jonathan or Ellen and made sure that we weren't publishing the same stories. And we don't. We occasionally talk about them electronically. But it turns out never to matter. Typical overlap is about 5 stories a book. And that's not enough to be a problem, I don't think. And we don't orchestrate that in any way whatsoever. Though I did have a writer one year when I had 2 stories by him I liked, and I told him that. He said, "Why don't you take the one that Gardner isn't taking?" So I agreed. They were both outstanding stories.
Well, back in the early days of my anthology, when Terry Carr was doing his Best of the Year anthology, we did make an attempt for a couple of years to coordinate our list so we wouldn't be duplicating the same stories, and it didn't work out well. Because somehow Terry, being older and shrewder, got the stories I really wanted to, and I was left with the other ones. So the next year I said, we're not going to do this anymore. Let the chips fall where they may. I'm going to use what I want to use, and you use what you want to use, and we'll see how it shakes out. To go way back to the beginning of the interview, I just thought of it when Rich mentioned that. I occasionally will use 2 stories from the same author and the best, if they're really good stories. I used 2 Robert Reed novellas last year, for instance, and I've done that with Greg Egan and Lave Tidar and a couple of other people. And I try to keep it down to no more than 3 stories from any particular anthology. Because, 3 at the most, because after that you're basically just sort of reprinting the anthology, and, mm-hmm. People who've already read the anthology aren't going to be really happy with that.
Well, I was wondering, hearing what you're talking about with your kind of the competition with Terry at one point, are there any stories that stick with you that you're still like, man, I wish I'd put that in there?
Yeah, sure. There are stories that I lost for one reason or another. They wouldn't sell me the rights, or the rights were encumbered. As a magazine editor, that happened a number of times where I would read something and not like it and reject it, and then, 6 months later, something, I would read it in some other magazine, and I would say, boy, this is really good. What was wrong with me that I rejected this? And it was just a bad day. I wasn't receptive. I was grumpy or something and didn't give it the chance it deserved. And, some other editor was smart enough to see what I didn't. And on the other hand, there are also stories that I rejected that went on to win major awards, and I still was happy that I had rejected it, because I read it again and said, this still stinks, so.
What about you, Rich?
Well, I was thinking there's definitely some of the stories I couldn't use for contractual reasons depressing me. There, one time I read a review of one of my books, and the reviewer said, words the effect of, "I don't know why Horton didn't pick this outstanding story." I did. I just couldn't use it.
Yeah.
Just from last year, I wanted to mention one story that I did read. It was on my short list, but didn't quite make it in the book. And then after that, I thought I should have picked that story. It ended up being nominated for a Nebula, and it's Charlie Jane Andrews' story, 6 Months and 3 Days, which was at Tor.com, and I thought, I liked it when I first read it, but I liked it more when I thought about it later, but by then it was too late. And that happens sometimes. Speaking of balancing, I remember one story about from Asimov's, the issue that you published, two stories about Fidel Castro as a major league pitcher.
Oh, yeah.
In the same issue.
Well, I did that deliberately because I had, as it happened, two stories about Fidel Castro being a major league baseball player, which almost happened, by the way, landed on my desk within about 2 days of each other. And this gave me a quandary because they were both good stories. And I knew that whichever one I published first would kill the other story because, you know, people would have seen the Castro gimmick already and they would, you know, not be impressed with the second story. I liked them both, so the only idea I could come up with was to publish them both in the same issue. And that seemed to work out well enough.
Based on the volume that you both read, who are some of the up-and-comers in the short story markets that we should be watching that we may not have heard of, that may have not even made the year's best list yet, or maybe even this year, somebody you've seen that's a new voice that we should be checking out?
I'll try to limit myself to the more recent writers that you probably possibly haven't seen, because you can look in my books or Gardner's books and see the writers who are obvious that ought to be. Plus, I don't want to get in a position of calling somebody a young new writer and they come back and say, I've been writing for 20 years. Where
20
were
years,
you?
What are you doing? Call me new, young.
That always happens.
Say thank you.
You know, I just read respect to complaints of age, though, I think normally they'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
So. Not like the time I called Kit Reed, a veteran writer, when she had been publishing for about 50 years, and she wrote a note to Gordon Van Gelder complaining in a very jocular way. Felicity Shoulders just had another story in Asimov's most recent issue that was quite different from any she had published before, and she had a very good fantasy in FNSF earlier this year. I think she's a writer. I haven't reprinted it yet, but she's always interesting. Last year at FNSF, Callie Wallace published a pretty impressive story, and she had a nice story earlier this year. She's a writer to keep an eye on. Alexandra Duncan has mostly been in FNSF for the past 3 years or so, and she's pretty strong new writer, too. I could go on, but let's let Gardner.
Well, you put your finger on the problem is who do you consider to be a new writer? I mean, I did 10 years of new young writer panels at one convention or another, and I was still a new young writer for 10 years. And everybody will have heard of people at different times in their career. So, you know, my new young writer may be somebody that you've been reading for 10 years. One of the newer writers who I think has been doing really first-rate work for the last couple of years is, I mentioned him before, Lavi Tidor, the Israeli writer, has been really doing some weird stuff. I could probably come up with a half a dozen others, but I would have to look at my best of the year to do so. That's the one that sticks out in my mind.
Well, excellent. Thank you. Thank you both for sharing. Gardner, Rich, we've truly enjoyed speaking with you both today about the state of short fiction. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Please visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com for show notes, videos, reviews, and more. And email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Some sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musicalley.com. No authors were permanently damaged in the making of this podcast.